The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Georgine Rice Show podcast. This program was originally broadcast live on 93.9 KPDQ. We hope you enjoy the show.
Well, good afternoon and welcome to the Tuesday edition of the Georgine Rice Show. Glad to have you with us. James Blind is producing, Clark Hilton Engineering, Dan Rice giving up his office space for the sake of the show. Today on the program, we're going to hear from Sid Brestel. He's the author of God in His Own Image, Loving God for Who He Is, Not Who We Want Him to Be. The book is published by Moody, and that interview will air in the second hour of today's program. So we'll start out with some of the day's headlines. Democrats are renewing their calls for Dr. Anthony Fauci and Deborah Birx, two leading members of the White House Coronavirus Task Force, to answer questions before the Senate about the U.S. response to the coronavirus outbreak. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer tweeted, Senate needs to hear from Dr. Fauci, Dr. Birx, Secretary Mnuchin. We need to know why so many small businesses have had trouble getting loans. We need to know why unemployment insurance checks are failing to get to workers. We need to know we still don't have enough tests. Well, Schumer said in an interview on the Rachel Maddow show on Monday that there is a chance the nation's top disease doctor will appear before the Senate next week, despite the White House's decision last week to prevent him from testifying before a House subcommittee. However, the Senate minority leader said Fauci's testimony is far from a sure thing, The Hill reported. By not telling the truth, by not hearing the truth, by not listening to scientists, they, referring to the Trump administration, are prolonging this crisis. They are prolonging how bad the economy will be, Schumer said. Does it surprise me? No. Does it upset me? A lot. End quote. Well, last week, the White House prevented Fauci from testifying and called such a testimony counterproductive with the coronavirus outbreak not under control. And while the Trump administration continues its whole of government response to COVID-19, including safely opening up America again and expediting vaccine development, it's counterproductive to have the very individual involved in those efforts appearing at congressional hearings, according to the White House spokesperson, Judd Deere. We are committed to working with Congress to offer testimony at the appropriate time. Meanwhile, explosive newly unsealed evidence documenting the FBI's efforts to target National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, including a top official's handwritten memo debating whether the FBI's goal was to get him to lie so we can prosecute him or get him fired, calls into question whether Brandon Van Grack, a Justice Department prosecutor and former member of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's team, complied with a court order to produce favorable evidence to Flynn. Since December of 2017, Van Grack has been obligated to comply with D.C. District Court Judge Emmett Sullivan's standing order in the Flynn case to produce all evidence in the government's possession that is favorable to the defendant and material either to the defendant's guilt or punishment. The order also requires the government to submit favorable defense evidence to the court, including possible impeachment evidence that could undermine witnesses, even if the government believes the evidence not to be material. Van Grack has long informed Sullivan that the government's so-called Brady obligations, referring to the prosecutor's duty to turn over exculpatory materials to defendants, has been met. Well, coronavirus victims are facing a new danger that may occur even after respiratory symptoms fade and infection from the virus clears. Doctors are beginning to notice a troubling blood clotting phenomenon, which is occurring more frequently in patients who have the virus. These clots are also being discovered in younger coronavirus patients and can result in sudden strokes or death. There's something about this virus that's exaggerated that to the nth degree. Dr. Mitchell Levy, chief of pulmonary critical care and sleep medicine at Warren Albert School of Medicine, according to Bloomberg, we're seeing clotting in a way in this illness that we have not seen in the past. You can add that to your prayer list. Well, one in four Democrats who watched Biden's denial on television a few days ago want a new candidate. Well, missing from the story, however, is how many Democrats felt this way before seeing the video. The poll finds women and voters under the age of 45 were less likely to find Biden's denial credible. Seeking a vice presidential appointment, Elizabeth Warren finds Biden credible and convincing. Ah, what a difference. the possibility of a vice presidential pick can make. Another story, Joe Biden's accuser, Tara Reid, is facing the former vice president's presidential campaign and the Democratic establishment without the type of pro bono legal and public relations support that Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh's accuser, Christine Blasey Ford, received. A different game altogether this time around. Well, the U.S. sees reasons for hope in the fight against COVID-19. Both Sunday and Monday saw a considerable drop in the number of deaths. President Trump said Americans are starting to feel good now. From Dr. Scott Gottlieb, mitigation clearly flattened the curve, which was its primary goal, saved lives, preserved healthcare system. But many expected the plateau to start declining. Yet we've been at a persistence about 30,000 cases, 2,000 deaths daily for more than a month. A story from Sean Trend notes that no states are on anything resembling an exponential growing trajectory. Almost all states are past a peak, and most states are substantially so. Later he writes, but in the meantime, there seems to have been a subtle shift in the discourse. Some of this has been a refusal to update prior assumptions. Some people seem to believe not much has changed since early March, but other analysts have subtly moved from the bend the curve to what we might call crush the curve. Under the latter approach, rather than looking to keep hospitals from becoming overwhelmed, which raises the fatality rate, we should look to avoid all fatalities. And the Washington Post seems nothing short of angry that the country is opening up. Meanwhile, the Washington Examiner points out the social distance police are still out there enjoying their power. Well, China systematically is shutting down the cries of coronavirus survivors there. From the story, the Chinese authorities are clamping down on grieving relatives along with activists, press the ruling Communist Party for an accounting of what went wrong in Wuhan, the city where the coronavirus killed thousands before spreading to the rest of China and the world. Lawyers have been warned not to file suit against the government. The police have interrogated bereaved family members who connected with others like them online, and volunteers who tried to thwart the state's censorship apparatus by preserving reports about the outbreak have disappeared. So again, things have not changed much under the communist rule. Well, as expected, the Pulitzer has gone to the flawed 1619 Project that even the New York Times is beginning to backpedal from after academics all over the country, African-American and otherwise, rejecting the flawed history. Well, after a year of increasingly petty spats with academics on Twitter and a significant correction after fact checkers confirmed that a key thesis of the 1619 Project was erroneous, Nicole Hannah Jones, the self-described Beyonce of journalism, won this year's Pulitzer Prize for commentary for her piece, "Our Democracy's Founding Ideals Were False When They Were Written. Black Americans Have Fought to Make Them True." From John Sexton, it is a bit odd that the committee overlooked the fact that the Times and author Nicole Hannah Jones were strongly criticized by a number of professional historians for the accuracy of claims made in the essay. One particular flashpoint was the claim that the Revolutionary War was prompted by a desire on the part of colonists to protect the institution of slavery. The Times literally refused to make any corrections to the piece after it was criticized by several experts in the field, but eventually, in March, they issued a belated clarification. Wilfred Riley, back in February, points out that explaining the many issues of the Times 16 Project would take a considerable amount of time. There were many inaccuracies. Byron York says the New York Times 1619 Project, awarded Pulitzer Prize, was subject to update and clarification after some top academic historians said it was unbalanced, one-sided, wrong in so many ways, not only ahistorical, but anti-historical, and flatly false in some areas. And yet, the Pulitzer Prize, because the story fit the narrative that was preferred. The story claims the New York shut down Samaritan's Purse due to the city's bigotry. That's a late news story. On Saturday, New York City's Mount Sinai Hospital decided to close the Samaritan's Purse emergency hospital constructed to help coronavirus patients in New York's historic Central Park. Sources said the decision came in part due to outrage at Samaritan Purse's Christian beliefs about marriage and sexuality. Didn't matter if they were saving lives and helping to bring aid and comfort to those who were suffering. What mattered was their Christian traditional beliefs. And Republicans are demanding that the FBI produce all documents related to the Flynn investigation. Representatives Jim Jordan and Mike Johnson on Monday demanded the FBI Director Christopher Wray provide a slew of information about last week's bombshell revelations in the case of former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. And the lawmakers are specifically seeking to question a mysterious FBI agent, Joe Pientka, who participated in the January 2017 White House interview that led to Flynn's prosecution. James Gagliano says, I know it sounds strange to hear me make such an accusation. I'm the guy who, he went on to say, who long attempted to thread the needle, accounting for honest human frailties, trusting that mistakes should not always be chalked up to malice or sinister intent. Cautious skepticism was a default mindset that served me well across a quarter century as an FBI investigator. That condition failed me here because one thing is clear, Michael Flynn got railroaded. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. We're taking a look at some of the day's news. Later in the 5 o'clock hour, we'll have a conversation with Sid Bressel, author of God in His Own Image, loving God for who He is, not who we want Him to be. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. Well, as some celebrate, assuming this only hurts big, rich moguls, Jerry Bauer says how this oil price shock really hurts the poor countries the most. So while we're paying less in terms of oil, it's really hurting those at the bottom end of the poverty continuum. And states are using Chinese drones to spy on their citizens. Jennifer Van Laar points out that the civil liberties aspect alone should be enough to ban the use of these drones by law enforcement agencies to spy on civilians. If that's not significantly alarming to those in charge of preserving and protecting our liberties, perhaps the fact that we're freely permitting a hostile government, one which has already unleashed a biological agent that's decimating our economy to gather a treasure trove of information about where Americans congregate and their traffic patterns, and more should raise enough red flags to force action by the administration. But I doubt anything will be done. On this day in history, 1961, astronaut Alan B. Shepard Jr., he becomes America's first space traveler as he makes a 15-minute suborbital flight aboard Mercury capsule Freedom 7. On this day in history, 1862, Cinco de Mayo, Mexican troops defeat French occupying forces in the Battle of Pueblo. 1891, New York's Carnegie Hall, then known as Music Hall, has its official opening night featuring Russian composer Peter Ilyich Tchaikovsky as a guest conductor. And on this day in history, 1925, school teacher John T. Scopes is charged in Tennessee with violating a state law that prohibits teaching the theory of evolution. Scopes would be found guilty, but his conviction was later set aside. On this day in history, 1934, the first Three Stooges short for Columbia Pictures, Woman Haters, is released. 1942, wartime sugar rationing begins in the United States. Sorry, I just had a moment there. Sugar rationing. On this day in history, 1945, the only deadly attack of its kind during World War II, a Japanese balloon bomb exploded in Gerhardt Mountains in Oregon, killing the pregnant wife of a minister and five children. 1994, Singapore canes American Michael Fay for vandalism, a day after the sentence was reduced from 6 lashes to 4 in response to an appeal by President Bill Clinton. 2009, Connie Culp, America's first face transplant recipient, appears before reporters at a Cleveland clinic. 2014, a narrowly divided Supreme Court upholds Christian prayers at the start of local council meetings. And finally, on this day in history, 2018, NASA launches its InSight spacecraft bound for Mars from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California, marking the first interplanetary mission ever to depart from the West Coast. May 5th also happens to be the birthday of my older brother. He would have been, 66 today. Well, dozens of protesters, some of whom were armed, gathered on Thursday inside Michigan's Capitol building to voice their opposition to the governor's stay-at-home order, with tensions high as lawmakers were poised to debate an extension of an emergency and disaster declaration. Holding American flags, handgun signs, or handmade signs, the demonstrators in Lansing first congregated shoulder to shoulder outside before demanding to be let inside the building. Some chanted, "Let us in," according to the Detroit News. One 66-year-old of Mason told the newspaper he attended the protest out of respect for others and not because he was worried about COVID-19. "I love freedom," he said. "In America, we should be free. Don't let them try to protect us from ourselves." Well, State Senator Dana Polhenke, a Democrat, tweeted a phone of what she described as armed demonstrators yelling above her. She said some of her colleagues were wearing bulletproof vests inside the House chamber. That ultimately became the story. In fact, Sean Hannity on his program pointed out that by coming armed with long guns, this show of force was not only dangerous, but it shifted the story away from the point they were attempting to make. He criticized the armed protesters who demonstrated in Michigan last week outside the Capitol. I'm the number one supporter of radio and television that I know of the First Amendment and the Second Amendment. Now, no one is a bigger defendant of the Second Amendment than yours truly, he said. Everyone has the right to protest, protect themselves, and try to get the country open, the host said in the video roll. This, with the militia, look here. And these long guns, he pointed out, show of force is dangerous. It puts our police at risk. And by the way, your message was never heard, whoever you people are. Again, the message never heard. The images, however, seared on the memories of the American people in that area who watched and listened. Meanwhile, a Kansas City mayor is defending a Nazi-like policy registering people who attend church. And this is beyond the idea of making note of who's been where in contact tracing. But a conservative law firm is calling a new order in Kansas City, Missouri, Nazi-like for requiring churches to surveil, track, and spy on anyone who attends an in-person service. But the mayor is pushing back on that characterization. Kansas City Mayor Quentin Lucas issued a rule on the 10th of this last month, in effect, May the 5th, ordering that non-essential businesses like churches, calling them non-essential, and that was offensive enough to many, can have 10 people inside and 50 people outside as long as they practice social distancing. And although the mayor said they need to keep track of those who come in for more than 10 minutes when he announced in late April, the written order states that they should consider maintaining a record of customers, which the mayor's office says is voluntary. In addition, non-essential businesses can operate at 10% maximum capacity. Well, the order states that by recording names and contact information, the health department will be able to more quickly trace, test, and isolate individuals who may have been exposed to COVID-19. The religious liberty group fears that anyone who doesn't provide this information won't be allowed in. Now, apparently it is at this point voluntary, and contact tracing is something that we can anticipate in the future. In fact, it's going to be essential in the state of Oregon, for example, in order for the state to begin opening up. Now, is that fair to refer to it as Nazi-like monitoring of citizens? Again, it's apparently voluntary, and it applies not just to churches, but other businesses. Well, the mayor in his announcement said, our goal isn't to see what everyone is doing and be Big Brother, according to the local news, but that's not how many in the community see it. At least one church feared its rights were being violated and contacted Matt Staver, founder of Liberty Council. They're targeting people, and you have to give them your name and contact information as a prerequisite, Staver said on a recent interview. What did they start doing in Nazi Germany? They started targeting people. They started to collect their names and their data so that they knew who they were and where they've been. Now, is that a fair characterization in this case? I'll have to leave it a rhetorical question at this point, since we don't have the capacity at this juncture to take calls in your response. I think contact tracing is something that is going to be a reality in a variety of settings. In this case, it's been applied to churches as well. But it's something to consider, should churches be exempt in terms of connecting people. If someone in the congregation, for example, is diagnosed with COVID-19, it's easier to contact people who may have been in close proximity to have them tested. That's the notion behind it. Anyway, we'll revisit that on another occasion. Well, Oregon Governor Kate Brown extended the state emergency through the 6th of July. And some people panic. Does that mean that we are destined to be closed as a state until the 6th of July. So what does it mean and how does it impact the separate stay-at-home order? Well, on Friday, Governor Brown signed an executive order that extends the state of emergency in response to COVID-19 through the 6th of July. The governor first declared a state of emergency on the 8th of March, and it was set to expire on the 7th of May. Well, extending the state emergency for Oregon doesn't mean she extended the stay-at-home order as a separate order from the state of emergency. Now, the state of emergency allows the governor to swiftly and fully deploy the personnel and resources necessary to address the virus outbreak. The state of emergency helps speed up assistance to communities. It makes resources available to those who need them. And when the state of emergency order was first issued in early March, officials say that the order would keep Oregon or allow them to help create more COVID-19 testing sites, bring in emergency volunteer healthcare professionals to add to services and so on, expand telemedicine and remote care. So it has more to do with what the state is free to do And continue to dismiss the extension of the emergency order. Charles Boyle, who's a spokesman for the governor's office, said that the extending of the state emergency gives the governor the authority to maintain executive orders issued up to this point, and it also gives the governor the authority to issue new orders if she deems necessary. Now, her stay-at-home order, which is a separate order from the state of emergency, was issued in the latter part of March, the 23rd. It doesn't have the a designated end date. The executive order states that it will remain in effect until terminated by the governor. So these are two separate entities, and the governor has left open-ended the stay-at-home order. On Friday, the governor said Oregon's strategy for reopening the state focuses on testing and contact tracing, which I just described in our earlier story. She sent a document to counties across the state, they're outlining seven prerequisites, which I shared yesterday, that have to be met before any county or region can enter the first phase of the governor's reopening Oregon plan. So two separate things. That state of emergency extension does not mean the stay-at-home order is automatically extended through the 6th of July. That is a separate order. It's open-ended, and we'll certainly continue to follow when that changes. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. We'll be back.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, we're back. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. Later in the program, we're going to hear from Sid Bristow, author of God in His Own Image, Loving God for Who He Is, Not Who We Want Him to Be. That's coming up in the second hour of The Georgene Rice Show. Well, the Oregon Health Authority reported on Monday no new deaths from COVID-19 for the second straight day, with the total remaining at 109. As of 8 a.m. on Monday, in its daily report, the OHA reported 65 new confirmed cases, 14 new presumptive cases. That included 10 new or presumptive cases in Linn County and 4 in Benton County. Now, presumptive cases are those without a positive diagnostic test who present COVID-19-like symptoms and had close contact with a confirmed case. Well, prior to Sunday, the last time the state didn't have a single coronavirus death in its daily report was on the 22nd of April. The last time before that was March the 29th. That's according to Jonathan Modi, public information officer for the Oregon Health Authority's COVID-19 response team. Oregon's first death from the coronavirus occurred on the 14th of March. We're really happy when we see we don't have fatalities on a given day, Modi went on to say. He struck a cautious tone, however, saying, "We are definitely not raising the mission accomplished banner. We still have a lot of work to do," he said. "We're still in this and still fighting it." Well, Modi said that the lack of fatalities over the past 2 days simply reflected the day-to-day fluctuations of the pandemic. Deaths on the report also represent a wide time range. In many cases, the deaths noted in the daily report occurred a day or more before the information was passed on from the local level to the health authority. Other new confirmed presumptive cases in the state as of Monday morning included Clackamas, Clatsop, Coos, Deschutes, Hood River, Jefferson, Lane, Marion, Multnomah, Polk, Umatilla, Washington, and Yamhill counties. Well, Oregon is going to begin reopening some state parks tomorrow. More are expected to follow, but Oregonians are about to get more access to the outdoors more than a month after parks and trails closed due to the coronavirus pandemic. Now, it's good news, but the list is very short. Oregon Governor Brown announced today that the state will begin to allow outdoor recreation areas to reopen this week, including select state parks, outdoor recreation facilities, and all ski resorts. The Oregon Parks and Recreation Department followed up shortly after with an announcement that 8 state park sites will partially or completely reopen to the public tomorrow, including popular park sites like Tryon Creek, Willamette Mission, the Cove Palisades, Pilot Butte, and Prineville Reservoir. Limited day use will slowly return to other state parks starting the week of May 11th. The Parks Department says, depending on the readiness of local communities and how prepared each park is with staff, supplies, and equipment. All recreation areas in the Columbia River Gorge will remain closed for the time being, as well as coastal areas that is not yet ready to welcome visitors back, she said. Well, officials warn that state parks may open and close with little notice. Updates will be posted online at OregonStateParks.org. Not all restrooms will be open. The park may be limited, the Parks Department says. Campgrounds at Oregon State Parks will remain closed with no anticipated date for reopening. The Parks Department previously announced that all reservations through the 25th of May had been canceled. Enjoying Oregon's beauty and bounty is one of our state's time-honored traditions, the governor said in the announcement. As we began to slowly open up recreation sites, state parks, ski area opportunities, it is critical we ensure the health and safety of staff, volunteers, and the public. And that begins with each of us taking personal responsibility to be a steward of our parks and of each other. Now, the full list of Oregon State Park sites that are set to reopen tomorrow: Tryon Creek in Portland, Willamette Mission north of Kaiser, Mongold Boat Ramp in Detroit Lake, State Capitol State Park in Salem, the Cove Palisades Boat Ramp at Lake Billy Chinook near Culver, Prineville Reservoir Boat Ramp near Prineville, Joseph Stewart Boat Ramp in Lost Creek Lake near Shady Cove and Pilot Butte, to pedestrians, no vehicles in Bend. But again, on May the 11th, that list is expected to expand. Well, at least 13 workers at an Oregon seafood processing plant have tested positive for COVID-19. Bornstein Seafood's entire workforce is now being tested for the virus while its Astoria facilities are shut down. 35 Bornstein Seafood employees were tested for COVID-19 on Saturday after showing symptoms of the virus, according to the company's news release. And Vice President Andrew Bornstein on Monday said that at least 13 have tested positive. At this time, our two Astoria seafood plants have been shut down, and we are working hand in hand with county health officials to increase testing and implement contact tracing. We are advising all of our employees to self-isolate and quarantine as advised by public health until further notice and guidance. Clatsop County health officials went to the company's Astoria seafood processing facility over 2 weeks ago to advise workers how to do their jobs while keeping distance from one another. Now the company's entire workforce is being tested for the virus. Bornstein Seafood first notified the county health department on the 1st of May that one of its employees tested positive. Well, some grocery stores are now limiting your meat purchases. You probably have noticed more changes at local grocery stores. Costco and Fred Meyer are now temporarily limiting the amount of meat customers can purchase at one time. This comes as some fear a meat shortage because of COVID-19, the pandemic. Meat processing plants and fish processing plants, at least one in Oregon, around the country have had to temporarily close because of COVID-19, spreading among employees over the past few weeks. Businesses like Olympia Provisions and Phil's Meat Market have been finding ways to adjust. We have opened up our supply lines, so we have 4 to 5 producers that versus the ordinary 1 to 2, says the owner of Phil's Meat Market. One plant that's been impacting shoppers here in the Northwest is the temporary closure of Tyson Fresh Meats plant in Washington. The company closed late last week so that they could test all of their 1,400 workers. John Wilson of Beef Northwest Feeders and Cattle Company in Eastern Oregon says it can take some time for plants to be up and running again. Wilson says it takes anywhere from 10 days to 2 weeks to open after being shut down, assuming interventions are in place. But Wilson's added that he doesn't expect to see a major meat shortage despite food processing plants stopping production over the last couple of weeks. He expects things to get back to normal in terms of a more typical supply by mid to late June. In the meantime, you're going to see some limitations put on what can be purchased. Well, we're hearing a lot about contact tracing. Earlier in the program, I talked about a church that took offense at the suggestion that the pastor and leadership there provide information, or at least collect information, on parishioners who come and go from services in order that contact tracing could be applied should someone within the congregation be diagnosed with COVID-19. Well, contact tracing is one of the critical elements to safely reopening the state. That's what the governor of the state of Oregon is saying, according to health officials here and beyond. It's also a huge undertaking. Washington County public health officials discussed how they need more people on their team in order to properly execute contact tracing. Local leaders and public health officials agree that Oregonians have saved lives by staying home. And while that's something to be proud of, they warn it will be a while before life is back to normal. Well, as normal as one can expect. Says Governor Kate Brown in a previous press conference, "I want to be clear that we will not be able to open Oregon quickly or in one fell swoop. This process will happen much more slowly than any of us would like." Well, that certainly is the truth. Well, according to Brown, at the top of the list of priorities is a strategy to test, trace, and isolate the virus. Last week, the governor outlined plans to contact tracing. It's a tedious process, but a key one if the state wants to relax stay-home measures without a drastic uptick in coronavirus cases. We ask them information about how long they've been sick, what symptoms they've had, and collect information on who they've been around, where they've been, says Dr. Christina Bauman, Deputy Public Health Officer for Washington County. Her team is working on getting more funding to contact trace. We're going to need about 180 individuals on our team to continue contact tracing over the next 6 months, says the Public Health Division manager for Washington County. She warned that as the state opens, a positive COVID-19 would bring life to a halt once again for the entire household. We'll need to move back to isolating cases, asking for volunteer quarantine of whole households, and so on. So this is one way to trace the contacts that an individual may have made during the time that they were no longer quarantined but out in the public. So it's going to be a fact of life for us for some time to come, as unpleasant as it may be and as reminiscent as it might seem to a bygone era that went horribly, horribly wrong. We'll continue to follow the story. Meanwhile, supporters are gathering outside Salem, a hair salon, as it reopens despite the governor's order. Supporters gathered outside a salon in Salem with signs saying that they supported the beautician. Lindsey Graham owns Glamour Salon in downtown Salem, and she reopened the salon at 10 a.m., going against the governor's orders. She told Fox 12 that at this point, she needs to start making money for her family. It's out of desperation. She's decided to move forward. This is a clear sign of how many people need to get back to work, she says. We will need to get back to work, and this proves it. Well, Graham says that she has a few stylists offering some services by appointment only. We're implementing a ton more sanitation procedures to make sure people feel safe because the majority are trying to support us. Many people were outside of the salon Tuesday morning to show their support. Jennifer Todmeyer, who told Fox News, rather, that she's a hair stylist, too. She says she applied for unemployment but hasn't yet received anything. Oregon is woefully behind. She says she's been living off of her savings. I'm here to support here for all of us, referring to hair stylists. We are essential as well. Well, at the state level, Graham said on Monday afternoon, a representative from OSHA told her she could face a fine and be told to close. And then at that point, if she remained open, she would face a much larger fine. Graham says she's willing to face an initial fine, but not a subsequent one. So my guess is the salon won't be open for very long. She'll get that initial fine and will be forced to close, but having made her point that she desperately needs to be able to support herself and her family. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. We'll be back.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
We're back. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. Coming up in the 5 o'clock hour, we'll talk with Sid Brestel, God in His Own Image. That's the title of the book, Loving God for Who He Is, Not Who We Want Him to Be. That's coming up in the second hour of today's program. Well, I'm always looking for the silver lining, and I think I have found the silver lining of COVID-19. The headline in the Oregonian, Naked Bike Ride Cancels Portland Gathering for 2020. Can I get an amen? Well, apparently the coronavirus pandemic has led to another canceled event. The World Naked Bike Ride will not go on as planned in June. Organizers announced on the event's website, due to the ongoing coronavirus outbreak and public health risk inherent in the massive gathering of naked people. Now, I would have thought before COVID-19 there was a health risk, but that's another story. Well, the annual event typically announces its starting location in advance, but not the route of the ride, so that you can't avoid it. That's the idea. To prevent crowds of onlookers. Yeah, that's the thing. They want to prevent crowds of onlookers, so they strip naked and ride their bike through town to prevent people from looking. That's why they do it, to prevent people from looking, and that's why they've taken their clothes off. Well, after gathering, cyclists are escorted by police through town. Okay, is it just me, or the naked bike riders are escorted through town by law enforcement? Now, if I were to take my clothes off and go stand in the middle of the street, that same law enforcement would send squad cars to pick me up and I would be incarcerated. But somehow you do it in a group and it's all right. Okay. Again, police escort the cyclists through town to the delight or disdain of local residents. But not this year. Hence the silver lining. Organizers say there will be no organized start time or location for a Portland ride. Instead, organizers say riders are encouraged to celebrate World Naked Bike Ride Day, riding wherever they'd like, whenever they like. Okay, let's see how law enforcement handles that. I can guarantee you, we won't even go there. Organizers initially announced a change on the 1st of April to the event, though they kept details vague. We simply must put the safety of Portlanders first. I would agree. Therefore, keep your clothes on in public at all times. That was my editorial edition. Organizers wrote at the time, we are bigger than this virus, and even if we have to ride circles in our living room in the buff, we will ride on. Okay, riding in your living room, of course, is one thing, but what about on the streets of Portland? Well, public nudity is actually illegal in Portland, but court rulings have made an exception for protests. The World Naked Bike Ride is officially a protest. Against dependency on oil for cyclist safety and in support of body positivity. So there's a protest against dependence on oil and cyclist safety. I guarantee you that when they're riding by in the buff, most people are not thinking, we really need to reduce our dependence on oil. And by the way, I think we need to be more careful with cyclists in town. Anyway, the Flint Police Bureau said in the past, it's allowed people to participate in the event as long as they stay on the route with the rest of the riders. Without an official gathering this year, nude cyclists might not receive the same protection. There's so much more that could be said, but I'll just leave it at that. That's pretty much all I can say. Well, taking a look at the state of Washington, several Republican state lawmakers there, have announced lawsuits to end the stay-at-home order. You can find those developments in Washington on the Columbia or on King 5. Phase 1 of reopening the state's economy started on Tuesday. Washington's stay-at-home order will remain in place until at least the 31st of May, with some restrictions possibly lifting mid-May. A total of 841 deaths among the 15,462 overall cases in Washington have been reported. And 216,000 people in Washington have taken a test for coronavirus, and 7.1% of those tested have been positive. Only 7.1%. It's still too high, but thankfully it's not higher. As I mentioned, Republican state lawmakers are filing suit to end the stay-at-home order. Several Republican lawmakers filed targeting Governor Jay Inslee. The lawmakers want to abolish it and reopen business. Signing onto the lawsuit are Drew McEwen, David Barkas, Brandon Vick, Chris Corey, Kelly Chambers, Drew Stoxby, and Morgan Irwin from Union, Olympia, Clark, Yakima, Puyallup, Auburn, and Enumclaw counties. A press conference was scheduled for 2 o'clock today. I didn't have a chance to see that, but their remarks were broadcast, and I'm sure they'll make the evening news as well. Meanwhile, Governor Inslee's stay-at-home order is in effect until the 31st, but starting today, Phase 1 of the Safe Start Washington paves the way for some businesses to reopen with restrictions. Phase 1, places like golf courses can begin operations again with a social distancing plan in place. More than 100 state parks will also reopen for day use, hiking and fishing, but camping remains prohibited. Outdoor activities like golfing and fishing can recommence. Again, we're talking about Washington, but people will have to take extra precautions. That is the era that we're in, and this will be the case for some time. The state is taking a four-phase approach to reopening, with an estimated 3 weeks between each phase. Today, the beginning of Phase 1. Meanwhile, King County Metro added 15 additional buses to 6 high-demand routes on Monday. The buses were added to routes where coaches are either reaching capacity or passing up customers to maintain social distancing guidelines. The routes include Route 7, 36, 180, A, Rapid Ride D, and Rapid Ride E. The additional buses will run on weekdays between 10 and 5, a time Metro has said they have the highest ridership and most reports of buses reaching capacity. You can ride, but you must be socially distanced. That, again, is the world we're in. Well, Carnival Cruise Line has canceled all of its Alaskan cruises from Seattle. The announcement came as Carnival said it would resume sailing again starting August the 1st. A Carnival Spirit Alaskan cruises from Seattle will remain canceled even after no sail restrictions were lifted. Carnival said all North American cruises from June to July are canceled, and Carnival Spirit Vancouver Honolulu cruises on September 21st and Honolulu Brisbane Trans-Pacific cruises on October 8th were also canceled, so they're looking clear into the fall. Former President Barack Obama and former First Lady Michelle Obama are getting ready to celebrate the class of 2020. The Obamas announced Tuesday they're going to participate in 3 virtual celebrations for graduating seniors in high school and college. The events include Show Me Your Walk, HBCU edition, Graduate Together, High School Class of 2020 commencement, and Dear Class of 2020 commencement address. Graduate Together was organized by NBA superstar LeBron James and features an hour-long primetime TV special airing on Saturday, the 16th of May, 5 o'clock Pacific time. The event will air live on ABC, CBS, Fox, and NBC and will be streaming on multiple online platforms, giving seniors at least something to hold on to. Well, the Seattle Police Department is sharing how it's been affected by the novel coronavirus. As of Monday, 24 Seattle Police Department employees were either in quarantine or isolation, and nearly 300 employees have returned to work following public health guidelines. The police department said a total of 7 employees had tested positive. Over 130 employees have tested negative for the virus at the police department. And again, we're talking about the state of Washington. Anything more specific here? Hundreds of Washington healthcare workers have been sickened by the coronavirus, and dozens of first responders in Washington state have become sick as well on the job. That, according to workers' compensation claims, the data provides some insight into how the coronavirus has impacted the healthcare community, but it's an underestimation. The real number isn't known because state and federal health officials have failed to collect that data, but it is certainly relevant. And Starbucks is reopening. They've announced its reopening locations across the United States and Canada starting Monday after some were closed due to the coronavirus pandemic. But it's not back to business as usual. Customers can expect a handful of adjustments, as they will everywhere else. A majority of stores will continue drive-through only service, while some locations may continue to operate only as a drive-through. Other stores will expand their current service to include order ahead and grab to go. And I think that'll probably cover it for the state of Washington. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. We've got news traffic coming up at the top of the hour. When we return, we want to make sure you have the opportunity to hear from Sid Brestel. God in His Own Image is the title of his book. We'll talk about that in the second hour of The Georgene Rice Show. We'll be back.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
We're back. You're listening to the second hour of The Georgene Rice Show. Coming up in our next couple of segments, we're going to hear from Sid Brestel. He's the author of God in His Own Image, Loving God for Who He Is, Not Who We Want Him to Be. The book is published by Moody. He'll join us in our next segment. Well, there's mounting evidence that suggests that the novel coronavirus can be transmitted from, let's see, pre-symptomatic and asymptomatic individuals, bolstering the argument for maintaining proper social distancing measures and possibly impacting the case fatality rate for COVID-19. That's according to a new review from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Now, we're hearing all kinds of bits and pieces that are encouraging and that are less so. But this is from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, so I thought it was worth mentioning. The agency looked at reports pertaining to pre-symptomatic and asymptomatic transmission that was published by PubMed in January, which is when the CDC recommended that the public wear face coverings to further stop the spread of COVID-19. Well, the instances of these transmissions included reports from China, Germany, and Singapore. And I'm quoting here, as the coronavirus disease pandemic caused by severe acute respiratory syndrome, coronavirus 2, unfolds, an increasing number of reports have indicated that some infected persons may not exhibit signs or symptoms of illness, including persons who are pre-symptomatic before the virus is detectable or asymptomatic. And the researchers wrote, the detection of, it's the long name is SARS-CoV-2 RNA, in pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic patients doesn't prove that they can transmit the virus to others. We describe evidence that supports the concept of transmission while pre-symptomatic and asymptomatic, which we found during a rapid literature review conducted by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Now, one of the issues raised with the reports out of China was the inability to rule out alternative exposure to SARS-CoV-2. But the cases of possible pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic transmission concerning Germany occurred before widespread community transmission. Singapore's instances further supported that possibility. All that said, there seems to be growing evidence that suggests that coronavirus spreads from those who have had, before there's any symptoms noted, from those who are asymptomatic, who have COVID-19 but have no symptoms, and pre-symptomatic, who've contracted it and symptoms have yet to appear, but will at some point in the future, which reinforces the notion that for the sake of others, because most of us don't know if we have it or not, For the sake of others, we need to take care. Now, speaking of take care, if you're looking for things to do during this season where you have a little more time on your hands, you don't have evening events to go to, you may be working from home, but maybe it's changed life for you somewhat as well. Well, Salem Media Group has made available No Safe Spaces. It's a political documentary about free speech from comedian Adam Carolla and nationally syndicated radio host Dennis Prager, two guys who could not be more different from one another. But they agree on one point, and that is the freedom of speech, which is being challenged in places you would expect it to be championed. The film exposes the toll political correctness is taking on college campuses, and despite the film's popularity, the filmmakers weren't able to strike a deal with traditional streamers because of the content of the documentary. So they took it to Salem. Salem said, yeah, we're going to do this. And it marks the first time that they're going to show a feature film online. So Salem is hosting this whole thing. The message of the film is how free speech and tolerance is being blocked by intolerant forces who say they believe in free speech, except when it comes to someone they disagree with. I want to encourage you to check it out. No Safe Spaces is now available to watch for a limited time only at nosafespaces.com for $19.95. Now, for KPDQ listeners, of which you are one, you can use the discount code SAVE25 for a 25% discount. Nosafespaces.com, SAVE25 for KPDQ listeners. Great documentary, and I would go so far as to say a must-see. We're looking at some of the things that are now being said about the coronavirus. One headline read, coronavirus infects more than 100 Oklahoma meatpacking plant workers. Earlier, we talked about the fact that you may find that you are limited in what you can purchase at the local meat market. Fred Meyer's, Costco are both now limiting what you can purchase per visit. More than 100 workers at a meatpacking plant in Oklahoma have tested positive for the novel coronavirus. A spokesperson for Seaboard Foods, which runs the plant, said in a statement on Monday that at least 116 employees at the pork processing plant in Guymon, which is located in Texas County, have tested positive. The plant employs about 2,700 people. Our message to employees continues to be, if you don't feel well, please stay home, contact your health care provider, and get tested. We believe this is the best way to protect our workers and our community. Well, to that end, we continually reinforce the importance of self-isolation and testing through the Texas County Health Department or other local departments in the region. But several former and current plant employees who spoke to the Oklahoman, the local paper there, on the condition of anonymity, said conditions at the plant are not conducive for social distancing, and some sick employees still went to work for fear they could lose their job. The owner said in a statement that the company had implemented a temporary COVID-19 leave policy and support plan to help employees who fall ill, including short-term disability pay for employees in the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention high-risk category. Well, investigators with the Federal Health Agency will be on the ground looking into outbreaks in nearby Moore and Potter counties, places where these packing plants are producing the meat you and I eat, to make sure that they are observing, and it's possible to observe, these social distancing standards, which will make life very challenging for some industries, and meatpacking might just be one of them. Well, now learning that the United Kingdom appears to now be the hardest hit country in Europe, after figures released on Tuesday showed the official death toll there from coronavirus surpassed 32,000. Only the United States has recorded more deaths attributed to COVID-19 virus. Of course, the United States is significantly larger in terms of geography and population, but nonetheless, the United States is the only country that has recorded more deaths than the UK at this point. Figures released by Britain's Office for National Statistics show that 29,648 deaths were registered in England and Wales with COVID-19. Mentioned on the death certificates through the 24th of April. It also includes suspected cases. With the addition of deaths in Scotland and Northern Ireland, the death toll in the UK rose to at least 32,000, according to Reuters. The figure far exceeds the death toll of 29,000 in Italy, which was long considered the epicenter of the outbreak in the European continent. Italy's tally does not include suspected cases, however. Experts have warned against international comparison, citing differences in demographics and different ways of measuring the number of deaths. The UK only just started adding deaths in nursing homes to its official statistics. Previously, it had only included those who died in hospitals. The UK has been hit very hard in the wave of COVID-19, and each death will have brought sadness to families. One professor from Oxford University, who is the director of the Rosalind Franklin Institute of Medical Research, told Reuters, Britain's health ministry appeared to downplay the new figure and warned on Twitter that ONS data should be handled with care because extrapolating or estimating figures based on historic data risks being extremely misleading, and we're certainly seeing that here in the U.S. Although there is no known scientific cure for the disease known as COVID-19, researchers have created an antibody that neutralizes SARS-CoV-2 in cells, offering the potential for prevention and treatment. Now, the study notes the antibody known as 47D11 was created in a lab environment and was able to inhibit the spike protein found in SARS-CoV-2 or COVID-19 or coronavirus, the virus that causes COVID-19 as well as SARS-CoV. Our data show that 47D11 neutralizes these viral compounds through yet unknown mechanism that is different from receptors binding interference, the researchers wrote in their study. Alternative mechanisms of coronavirus neutralization by targeting antibodies have been reported, including spike interactivation through antibody-induced destabilization of its prefusion structure 17, which may also apply to 47D11. I'm sure you've caught all of that. The point being that they have a man-made antibody that, at least in the lab, has neutralized the coronavirus for the first time. The implications for its use in humans, we don't yet know. It will take a very long time before that's even a possibility to be tested. So, again, just a little glimmer of good news in the midst of all of this. Another headline, which was contradicted by a headline I read elsewhere, said a new mutation indicates that the coronavirus might be weakening, others suggesting that the mutation indicates just the opposite. So headlines can be somewhat misleading, and there are so many of them telling us one thing or another, and then we come back and find out something else altogether is the case. So we try to provide information, but again, this is a moving target, and we're not altogether clear what's true today and whether or not that will remain true into the future. So take that into account. Up next, we'll talk with Sid Brestel, God in His Own Image, loving God for who He is, not who we want Him to be. That's up next on The Georgene Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Well, it's easy to speak to others about Jesus, who cared for the poor, healed the sick, preached love and justice for the least of these. But what about the God who tells the Israelites to wage war and kill entire people groups, or threatens exile and then delivers, or sends people to hell? Can these really be the same God? These are questions my next guest asks and answers. Well, the simple answer is yes. God in His Own Image, his book, takes you on a journey through the Bible exploring God's true nature. You'll study instances of great mercy and great severity, and by the end, you'll begin to see why both God's compassion and His wrath are necessary, important, and even beautiful. Get to know the God who is both Lion and Lamb, both Judge and Father, both kind and severe, and perfect in every way. My next guest is Sid Brestel. He is a retired pastor who served a number of congregations for nearly 50 years. He's taught biblical classes at Kilns College in Bend, Oregon, and is passionate about creating opportunities for lay people to receive biblical and theological training. He's ministered in several countries, and God has given him a passion to reclaim and defend both His grace and His holiness and wrath. The book that he has written, something of a reluctant author, is titled God in His Own Image, Loving God for Who He Is, Not Who We Want Him to Be. I should also mention he is a graduate of Western Seminary. So we're talking to a homebody, if you will. Sid Brestel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Georgine. What a privilege to be on the air with you.
Oh, thank you. And it's a privilege.
I pastored 13 years in Portland, so we kind of belong there, too.
So you are back home then, huh?
I am.
Wonderful. Well, I so appreciate your book. I spent an entire year, it's been 2 years now, studying the book of Revelation. I've spent an entire year studying the people and the promises from the early books of the Bible in order to better understand who God is and who He reveals Himself to be, to try to dispel some of the misunderstandings I might hold of His character and who we know Him to be from Scripture. And your book is really designed to help us better understand what God says about Himself and how He wants us to understand Him in real life, if you will.
Yes, and I wanted to get that down on a lower shelf. I'm not writing to the theologian. I'm not writing to the professors. I'm trying to write to the average person in the church who just needs to know who God is and accept Him as He is.
One of the things that you encourage your readers in the preface to consider is Romans 11:22, when Paul writes, "A note then, the kindness and the severity of God." Now, this seems like a contradiction. How can both things be true? And yet they are. We grapple with how to understand how both things are simultaneously true and reflect a holy and good and merciful God. Is that the heart of the challenge that we face in trying to understand who God really is?
I think you've hit it right on the head. And that really was the key to writing the book to begin with, that verse. Because that word severity only appears in that verse alone, and appears twice in that verse. God, Paul could have used words like wrath or anger. Why did he choose that one? So it piqued my curiosity, and it was the research and the word study that then led to writing the book. And I really think that's the struggle we have today. We live in a consumer-driven society. It has influenced the churches for the best part, or the biggest part. And we want a God that's safe, one that we can manage. We like to talk about his grace. We like to talk about his mercy, his love, his goodness. And those are good things, and we need to talk about them. But grace and mercy, Georgine, have no meaning at all if God isn't also holy and just and capable of wrath and anger. That's why I need mercy, mm-hmm. and that's why I really enjoy grace. And I think today we want to make God safe. I think of C.S. Lewis when he speaks about Aslan, the lion, and the child asks, "Is he safe?" The answer is, "He's not safe, but he is good."
Mm-hmm.
And so the book may sound like it's all about God's wrath. It's not, but I really end up talking about taste and see. He is good, even in his anger. He's good. As I was listening to the commercials and such prior to me coming on, it talked about 1 in 7 women being molested or abused.
Mm.
If bad things happen and no one gets angry, the opposite of the anger is apathy. I don't want a God who's apathetic. When little children are hurt, when the women are abused, when people who have no defense are harmed, I want somebody who's going to stand up and defend. And God, throughout the Old and the New Testament, talks about helping the poor, the widow, looking out for them. So he is a God that even in his anger, it's not a temper tantrum. It's a righteous response to evil and wrong.
One of the mistakes that we make, and you use this quote, someone once noted that God made us in his image, and ever since, we've tried to do God a favor by making him in our own. God is so other that it's difficult for us to understand how it's possible for two seemingly opposite things to exist in a single being. Is part of our problem that we, being made in the image of God, find it very difficult to acknowledge that we are incapable of fully comprehending all that he is, and yet he reveals aspects of his character in order to be understood, and we should strive to do that because that's what he longs for from us, is to seek him as he is rather than the image that we would prefer him to be in.
That's right, and if he doesn't reveal himself to us, then we're up on our own to mm-hmm. create him the way we want him to be. He has revealed himself to us in his word, in creation. But in creation, I see some of the awesome attributes of his creativity, his beauty, his love for beauty. But it's in the word and in the person of Christ. I see that he's a person who wants a relationship with us. He's a father who loves us. He's not an abusive father. He's not an absent father. He's a God that cares. And yet he's a God that expects obedience, honors obedience, and will discipline when disobedient. But the discipline is always, again, done in love. I think through the Old Testament, and he talks to Israel as his child and sometimes as his bride. And when Israel goes out and creates other gods, that is, the gods of the nations around them, that's when God's righteous anger really comes out. The 70 years captivity, the Assyrian captivity of the northern tribes, were a result of his people ignoring how he had revealed himself and bowing down to something they had made with their own hands. You know, I share in the book an analogy. To create an idol and bow down and say, "You're my creator," is as insulting is walking into the Sistine Chapel and seeing that great fresco, all those great frescoes painted by Michelangelo, and say, a kindergartner could have done better. That's an insult.
Mm-hmm.
No wonder God responds to idolatry as he does in the Old Testament.
Well, let's talk about the... Go ahead.
I think what happens today, too, is... let me use an analogy. I would never, as a pastor, invite somebody to come to the church and tell the people, make an idol out of wood and bow down to it. But if I don't tell them the truth about God, both the kinder and the gentler, but also the severe attributes, then I have essentially done the same thing. I've told them, here's an idol, go worship it. It may not be made with hands, it may not be made out of wood, but it's not God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You use the phrase Old Testament. Let's talk about that, because there are many believers today who have simply jettisoned the, in quotes, Old Testament as being the a different God than the New Testament Jesus that we see, and they delineate between the two as one being no longer relevant and this new and improved version in the New Testament, that's the God that they want to know, without taking into account that the scriptures, as you use the phrase, older and newer testament, speak of one truth, of one God, whose character is consistent.
I appreciate you bringing that up. And it was one of my professors at Western, Dr. Ronald Allen, who uses the phrase older, newer. And so I picked up on that. Recently, I read some other person saying first and second. The problem with saying older, Old Testament, it could communicate old, outdated. And now new means it's up to date. The old one has been cast aside. We have but one book. Every one of the 66 books adds something to the story, whether it be in the older chapter of the library, section of the library, or the newer section. It's really wrong for people. I think it's absurd when people say, I love the sweet Jesus of the New Testament. I don't like the angry God of the old. Same person. And if they really say that, and they haven't read the New Testament. Mm-hmm. I don't see a meek, mild Jesus taking a whip and cleansing the temple and upsetting carts and driving out the money changers. I don't see a gentle Jesus calling the Pharisees and the legalists whitewashed tombstones and snakes. And you said you spent two years going through Revelation. You read through Revelation, it's the revelation of a person, Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, if you can't read that book and not say that he's severe. As we come to the end of part of Revelation, his severity is just outstanding. With the sword from his mouth, you know, obviously it's symbolism, but riding on a horse with a blood-stained robe, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. I wonder if they even read the New Testament, if they say that I love the sweet Jesus in the New Testament, I don't like the angry God of the old. Maybe they watched the movie, but I don't think they read the book.
Yeah. We're going to take a quick break, but we will continue our conversation. In the preface, my guest, Sid Brestel, writes that contemporary Christian culture has diminished, if not abandoned, biblical teaching about God's harsher attributes. An angry God doesn't sell well in our consumer-driven culture, but God is not an item on the shelf trying to appeal to our preferences. We don't have to sell him or market him. He is who he is. Neither are God's attributes a box of chocolates. We can't pick or choose our favorites. We'll continue our review of God in his own image, loving God for who he is, not who we want him to be. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Continuing my conversation with Sid Brestel. He is a retired pastor. He's pastored here in the Portland area, is a graduate of Western Seminary, and the author of God in His Own Image, Loving God for Who He Is, Not Who We Want Him to Be. What are some of the more dangerous misunderstandings of who we think God is, rather than who God reveals himself to be?
Good question. And in the book, I try to give some pictures, word pictures, to help explain that. Some people might see him as a stern taskmaster.
Mm-hmm.
He's just abusive. He wants you to, you know, work a little harder. I grew up with what I would call the cosmic cop God. It was a very legalistic church. My dad was a pastor. He was also a police officer, so I'm a loser on both sides there with my peers. Cosmic cop. When I'm in trouble, he can't get there fast enough. But I don't want him looking over my shoulder. I don't want him always spying on me. Every time I want to do something, he's there to catch me. He can't relate too well with that kind of a God. Sometimes the absent landlord. And this is a hard one, because maybe all of us have been there sometimes when we're going through trials and pain and suffering, and we pray and the prayers bounce off of the ceiling, and God is absent. That's what I would call the absent landlord. And it's interesting that in the Psalms, the number one genre, the most common genre in the Psalms are the Psalms of lament. Why, oh, why, God? Where are you, God? How long, God? So sometimes we might see God as that absent landlord. And there's another type of God that I think some people create, and that's what I call the doting grandfather. Doesn't matter what you do, boys will be boys. God is too good to send anybody to hell. He just has to forgive us, because that's what God has to do. That's what grandpas do. Perhaps today we would say there are those maybe in the more New Age type religion that God is just energy or force. Star Wars, let the force be with you. That's a pantheistic God. It's not a personal God. So I just kind of use the caricatures mm-hmm. to try to give pictures in people's minds of how we sometimes try to make God out. And he's none of those. He's far more than that. Now, when God introduced himself to Moses there on the mountain, that's a great journey. Moses starts out totally frightened at the burning bush. Take off your shoes, it's holy ground. And then God almost kills him on the road to, on the path to Exodus, because he hasn't circumcised his sons. He hasn't kept a covenant, a sign of the covenant. But Moses becomes so familiar with God that he says, I want to see everything. I want to see your glory. But when God introduces himself to Moses, he starts out with the gentler, kinder attributes. And then he turns and he says, but I will punish. And so he's both. He's both that forgiving, gracious, loving, always. But he's also that God who will not compromise with sin, will not allow his character to be slandered, insulted with idols, and he will respond. But again, he always responds rightly. That's what righteousness is. He responds in the right way. Not the way I might think he should mm-hmm. do it, but he knows what's right. When God makes decisions, I have to remember, it's his courtroom. This is his land. This is his world. He's the creator. He knows so much more than I do. I can only see one little moment. I can't see the next moment. I forget about the last moment. But God sees it all. I can trust him. I was meeting with a man recently over the last year who lost his wife. I mentioned him in the book, but a light went on about a month ago in one of our meetings over breakfast. And I simply said, sometimes we just need to trust him. I don't need answers. I just need to trust him. And I think that's what God wants us to do with yeah. him, trust him. He reveals himself to us. We say we love him. We say we trust him. Let's just live it. Trust him.
What do you say to those who are perfectly satisfied with only embracing one facet of God's character without the more troubling facets that require us to perhaps dig a little deeper in Scripture? For example, as I studied with Bible Study Fellowship through the Scriptures and some of the nations that Israel was commanded to destroy, if you look at the Scriptures and you go back to the very early part of Genesis, there are references to those nations, and you see the mercy of God giving decades, hundreds of years in some cases, before God exercises judgment. There had been warnings for nations and so on. It's a much bigger picture that has more detail. What do you say to those who are content to say, you know, I'm only interested in this facet of God's character? What do we miss out on, and how does that make our Christian walk anemic if we are not willing to embrace all of who God is and try to at least understand him?
I don't want to sound trite, Georgine, but I would say to them, you're not worshiping God. You're worshiping an idol, something you've created. Maybe not out of wood, maybe not out of stone, but in your mind, you've created something less than God, an idol. And that's dangerous. I was listening this afternoon on YouTube to an interview with Eugene Peterson. And he made a statement in there which kind of shocked me, because he's such a gentle man. But he said, a consumer-driven church is an antichrist church. Those are harsh words.
Mm-hmm.
But if I try to reconnect or re-describe God to fit what's popular, what's politically correct, like Peterson uses harsh words, that's not Christ. That's Antichrist. So I think it's time that we need to tell these people, you know, back off, man. That's dangerous. That's dangerous. It's not only wrong, but it's dangerous. Jesus praying in John 17, and he says, he speaks to the Father, you have given me authority over to give eternal life to all that you have given me. And this is eternal life, that they may know you, the only true God. Eternal life is to know God as he is. It's a matter of life and death. Knowing God, accepting God as he is.
What role does and should God's Word and His Holy Spirit play in helping us when we have a willing and open heart to better understand who God is as He reveals Himself?
I think when we have that open and willing heart to know and love and understand God, His Word will be opened to us. The Spirit will communicate to us through His Word, will affirm in our hearts. So I think it starts again with that hunger. I use a phrase in the book, Taste and See, and I just talk about the proof is in the pudding. Well, just have a hunger to know God. That honors God. I think if he sees a heart, even in the darkest point of Africa, who's hungry to know the real God, like we're reading about Muslims today who are hungry, and Jesus appears to them. We read about it more and more these days. If somebody's genuinely searching with an open heart, God will reveal himself to us, whether it be in a vision for a Muslim or whether it be in his word through a searching Christian or a searching American who's pre-Christian, yet to believe. I think we have to trust his word. I think he honors the heart and a willingness to surrender. Yeah. Lord, I accept however you reveal yourself in the word. Now I'm going to open your word. You show me who you are. And he will.
Yeah, yeah. I love that you make the reference, someone who has a genuine heart to know God. And God will honor that as we pursue him.
Yeah.
Well, certainly our conversation doesn't reflect all that's in your book, God in His Own Image. I appreciate so much how you help us better understand perhaps some of our flawed thinking and our unwillingness to look at the full portrait that God provides for us in His Word. But the book will help all of us take up the challenge and the joy of knowing God as He reveals Himself. The subtitle, Loving God for Who He Is, Not Who We Want Him to Be, and the book is published by Moody. Thank you so much for joining us today. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you, Georgine.
Again, Sid Brestel, our guest. Thank you so much.
You're listening to the Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, we're back. You're listening to the final segment of the Georgine Rice Show. Well, the Supreme Court has had to adjust to everything that's going on. And for the first time, the Supreme Court held its argument by phone. It's a morning of firsts for the Supreme Court. The first time audio of the court's arguments was heard live by the world, and for the first arguments by telephone. Well, the changes were a result of the coronavirus pandemic, of course, which has made holding courtroom sessions unsafe, especially with six justices age 65 and older, some significantly older, and at risk of getting seriously sick from the virus. Well, the historic session began at the usual time, 10 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, when Marshal Pamela Tolkien called the court to order and Chief Justice John Roberts announced the day's case. Oyez, oyez, oyez. Tolkien began. She dropped the words commanding people to draw near to reflect the unusual circumstances. Arguments scheduled to last an hour, as they would generally in the courtroom, ran 17 minutes long, but without serious problems. The justices asked roughly two questions apiece at a time. Justice Roberts occasionally interjected to keep things moving, and there was one mild surprise. Justice Clarence Thomas asked questions for the first time in more than a year. Several justices said good morning to the lawyers, a telephone nicety not often heard in the courtroom. The justices also didn't interrupt each other, which is easier to do when you're by phone, for the first time in more than a year. So, that's a rather interesting thing. They frequently do interrupt one another in court. Instead, they took turns asking questions. They were more cordial. The court's plaza, normally bustling with on the mornings of arguments, was deserted on Monday, as it's been since the building was closed to the public in mid-March because of the virus outbreak. 2 months of arguments were postponed before the court decided to hear 10 cases over 6 days in May. Well, the experiment could propel the court to routinely live stream their arguments, or it could just be an extraordinary exception to the court's sustained opposition to broadcasting the audience so that an audience can hear if it's something new. Now, having the audio available is one thing. Having video available where lawyers are tempted to grandstand is something altogether, so they might be more open to audio, if not video. Anyway, cases that will be heard over the next 2 weeks include President Donald Trump's efforts to shield tax and other financial records, and whether presidential electors have to cast their electoral college ballots for the candidate who wins the popular vote in their state. The court chose a somewhat obscure case about whether to travel. The travel website Booking.com can trademark its name for its first foray into remote arguments. The lawyers on both sides are well known to the justices and experienced in arguing before the nation's highest court. Justice Department lawyer Erica Ross, who once served as a law clerk for Justice Elena Kagan, was first up. She last argued at the court in late February. She delivered this Supreme Court argument, her sixth, from a Justice Department conference room. She was followed by a one-time government lawyer who will be arguing her 40th Supreme Court case. Ms. Lisa Blatt will be at her Washington area home, she told the Washington Post. She's known for her colorful writing and speaking style and her ability to engage in a healthy give and take with the justices. Each lawyer got 2 uninterrupted minutes to make their opening statement, after which Justice Roberts kicked off the questioning. After that, the justices asked questions in order of seniority. Kavanaugh, who joined the court in 2018, went last. It was an historic occasion. It will be repeated a few times, perhaps more than a few times, given this pandemic and the likelihood that it will continue to impact how things are done pretty much everywhere for some time. Meanwhile, a federal judge has issued an order demanding that a group of pro-life activists who were behind a series of undercover videos taken at Planned Parenthood facilities and abortion conferences are liable for more than $1.2 million in damages. The U.S. District Court Judge William Orrick of the Northern District of California released an order on Wednesday against individuals connected with the Center for Medical Progress. At issue was an unfair competition law claim brought by Planned Parenthood and the plaintiff's California Business and Professions Code. Orrick ruled in favor of the claim, citing a jury verdict from last November that found CMP, the organization, the Center for Medical Progress, its founder David Dalyden, an activist, including Troy Newman of Operation Rescue, guilty of violating several laws when investigators went undercover at Planned Parenthood facilities and events. In addition to issuing an injunction banning those named from attending Planned Parenthood events, Orrick also found them liable for large sums of money. This includes $1,259,370 in damages related to Racketeer Influenced and Corruption Organization Act, plus other damages and attorney's fees. It's really remarkable that these were applied in this case, but nonetheless, they have been ordered by this court, which I'm a federal judge, to pay $1.2 million to Planned Parenthood. Well, on Wednesday on the program, we're going to talk with Josh McDowell. He's done some considerable work about the status of the church during and following the coronavirus pandemic. What changes are likely to be made, some of the things that churches should anticipate having to address because of our sheltering in place that aren't necessarily flattering, but it does reveal the challenge of maintaining one's character under extraordinary circumstances. On Thursday, we'll talk with Scott Rank, author of History's 9 Most Insane Rulers. The book is published by Regnery. I've also invited Dennis Hayes, who is the general manager of not only KPDQ, but a cluster of stations here in the Portland market, to talk with him about how he is faring and how all of this is impacting the communications business here in the state of Oregon. We'll talk with Bill McLeod with Mission Connection. The National Day of Prayer is on Thursday, and that will be the topic of our conversation, among other things, with Bill McLeod. Then on Friday, I'm looking forward to taking the day off. That is going to be my 38th wedding anniversary, and Dan Rice and I are planning on spending some time alone together to reflect and celebrate. So I'm not sure where we're going to go or what we're going to do. We might just get a takeout meal. I wouldn't have to cook, and that might be it. But nonetheless, we'll be celebrating, as well as on the following Monday. And Pastor Rich Jones and Matthew Dodd are going to guest host the program on Monday of next week. So do make note of that. That's going to be really good, I promise you. I want to thank James Blinn for producing, Clark Hilton for engineering, and Dan Rice for the use of his office. And thank you for making the Georgine Rice Show part of your day. Have a great night.
Thanks for listening to the Georgine Rice Show podcast. If you'd like to download a podcast of the show or would like more information on today's guests, please visit the show at kpdq.com or on Facebook. Follow the show on Twitter at GRice Show and like us on Facebook. And join us live every weekday at 4 for more critical thinking for critical times on 93.9 KPDQ.